Thank you. It's a pleasure to be speaking here. Today I want to talk about a generalization of Weyl's converse theorem, an analytic generalization. I'm going to try to go through all details because I think, I hope there's sufficient interest. I'll warn you that to say everything takes about an hour and 15 minutes. So I've had to cut and trim here or there, and we may be in for a bit of a wild ride. So let's see how it goes. All right, I'll start by recalling one version of Weyl's theorem, so 1967. It goes as follows. Suppose I've got, I give myself an L function, which I'll call LSF, okay, sum of, given my Dirichlet series, okay, for some coefficients AN with a polynomial bound like this. So in particular, this defines an analytic function in a right half plane for real part of s greater than sigma plus 1, okay, and some integers k and n, positive integers. Okay, then for primitive Dirichlet characters, chi, say, we can define twisted L functions, as in the last talk. So we define okay, and also complete L functions that we get by attaching to this thing a gamma factor. Now, you may be used to seeing here just 2 pi to the minus s gamma of s. The reason for this shift of k minus 1 over 2 is that I'm using the analyst normalization, so eventually I'll assume that these coefficients are of size 1, and that the functional equation that I write down in a minute takes s into 1 minus s, not k minus s. Okay. Then Weyl's theorem is as follows. Suppose we have the following 3 conditions. So for each chi of prime conductor, and we can focus on those of prime conductor Q, not dividing my level N. Okay, suppose we have for each of those, these following 3 things. The complete L function continues to an entire function. Okay, analytically continues. Satisfy some boundedness condition, so we need some control over the analytic properties of this function, not just that it continues, but is bounded in vertical strips. This is so we can do things like shift contours on an integral against this function. And 3, satisfies a precise functional equation. I'll see what that means in a second. Of the following form. Okay, so here's the functional equation, where this factor epsilon is a certain precise thing. That's what I mean by precise functional equation, basically the square of a Gauss sum here. And the functional equation relates F cross chi to F cross chi bar. Okay, so I'm basically in the self-dual situation here. Then the conclusion is, if I write down the following form, which I'll call F, then this thing is a modular form, cusp form, for gamma naught n. Okay. Or by abusive notation or abusive terminology, I'll say that LSF is modular. And I'll put that in quotes. Okay. Now, this is certainly not the most general version of this theorem. I haven't even stated it for non-trivial Nevin types, which you can. You can also generalize it to Mach forms or to number fields, although if you're going to work over number fields, one usually works adelically at that point. Okay, so yeah, this is certainly not the most general version, but in all cases, in all generalizations of this, you have the same three basic ingredients here. Analytic continuation of the complete L function, boundedness in vertical strips, and precise functional equation. Okay, what I want to describe today is a generalization of this that in some cases will allow us to eliminate twists. Okay, so then precisely, what I have, okay. Let's take the same setup. Okay. But suppose, okay, I'm going to replace these three conditions with three of my own and add two more. So suppose we have the following. Condition zero, that LSF is given by an Euler product. Okay, and Bayes' theorem works completely additively, but I'm going to assume we're given an Euler product. And all I mean by this is that LSF is given by a product over primes, where each local factor is the reciprocal of a polynomial in p to the minus s. I don't assume any more than that. Nothing on the degree or the uniformity of the degree, anything like that. Just that everything is a polynomial. One prime, which replaces condition one. Suppose that LSF cross chi has meromorphic continuation. So it's the same setup as here. So I've got I define the same complete L functions. Okay, but here the main improvement will come from the fact that we can assume just meromorphic continuation. To see, with some control over the poles, so I do need to know something about the poles. So with poles possible only in the critical strip, strictly inside the critical strip. Okay, I'm going to assume that outside the critical strip and on the edge that we understand the function, that it's analytic there. Okay, 2 prime, what replaces 2? So this doesn't make sense anymore if it's a meromorphic function. The correct analytic thing to assert here is that is a ratio of entire functions of finite order. Okay. 3 prime, same functional equation. Now interpreted in the land of meromorphic functions instead of holomorphic functions. Okay. And finally, 4, and the most stringent condition, is that LSF itself has at most finitely many poles. Okay. Then, the conclusion is the same. LSF is modular. Okay. Now you might say, well, what's the big deal here? There's not much difference analytically between a function with finitely many poles and an entire function. And that's true. If I were assuming this condition, finitely many poles, for every twist, then this would not be much of an improvement. Okay. The main improvement comes from the fact that while this condition 4 must hold for LSF, the weaker conditions, 1 prime, 2 prime, and 3 prime, for which I only need meromorphic continuation, these are the only ones that are for all chi. Okay. All chi is in Bay. Sorry? Still prime conductor, yeah. okay. So what is this good for? We'll talk about an application. I hope to convince you that in some ways this could be considered a typical situation to be in, actually, where you might know meromorphy up to some number of poles. Okay. Suppose I take a Galois extension of the rational numbers, okay, E over Q, and a representation of its Galois group, okay, a finite dimensional complex representation, say irreducible and non-trivial. Okay. Then associated to this representation, Artin defines an L function. Defined LS rho, and indeed it's given by an Euler product, so a product over rational primes in this case, okay, for each prime you pick a Frobenius element, okay, look at its action on V, okay, to take this particular determinant. Okay, this is not the correct definition of P as ramified. Okay, there's some slight subtleties there. I'm not going to go into that inverseness. Okay. So, but one point to note here is that it is a polynomial in P to the minus S, so 1 over a polynomial in P to the minus S. So this 0 is satisfied. You might say, actually, that anything that deserves to be called an L function automatically satisfies 0. So in applications, this is not really a restriction. Okay. What's the motivation for writing down such a thing? Well, if you take, for example, E to be a cyclotomic extension, okay, then all representations are, in fact, characters, and they boil down just to Dirichlet characters, in fact, and this reproduces Dirichlet L functions. So perhaps motivated by that, Artin conjectured the following, 1923. That LS rho has an entire continuation and satisfies a functional equation of the form basically of this form over here. And I won't write it again. Okay. So you attach to LS rho some gamma factors, and you get a functional equation relating S to 1 minus S. Okay. No. So this is all general here. Okay. Yeah, that's true. Okay. All right, fine. I'll just I'll write it out then. Gamma of S LS rho equals some root number conductor to the half minus S, gamma of 1 minus S, okay, where rho bar is the conjugate representation here, okay, and gamma is some product of gamma factors like this, so we'll take more than two of them in the general case. Okay. Now, in 1923, Artin was not sure of the right factors to put at ramified primes. It wasn't until 10 years later that he was sure of that and knew what the right functional equation should be. Okay? So this was initially a vague conjecture. But he did make it precise 10 years later. And in fact, so one-dimensional. Huh? Well, I think it comes down to the same thing. In this case, yeah. Yeah. So, yeah, contra gradient, but. Yeah, they're finite dimensional. Yeah, right. Okay, the one dimensional case is known, settled by Artin, in fact, through the development of class field theory. Well, okay, so I formulated this over Q, and there they're just Dirichlet characters, but more generally, if I were to formulate this over a number field, the one dimensional case is known. And also some two-dimensional cases known. So the dihedral case sum. dihedral case was also known to Artin. Okay, it follows from the abelian theory. And also, so I should say that most progress to date on this has come through the Langlands program, which anticipates not only this analytic continuation and functional equation, but that these Artin L functions are actually automorphic L functions. Okay, so in particular, the two-dimensional tetrahedral and octahedral cases are known, okay, from the Langlands tunnel theorem. All right, what do we know in general? So perhaps I can put it here. In general, so from Brouwer, from Brouwer's theorem in 1947, we get that where, so we get a factorization of LS rho into L functions of Hecke characters, so that these lambda I's are Hecke characters over intermediate subfields, Ki. Okay. And these EIs are integers. Okay. The trouble here is that these EIs can be negative integers, in fact. They need not be positive. So what you get out of this theorem is the meromorphic continuation and functional equation of the LS rho. Functional equation. Okay. Let's see here. I want to go over here. But basically, the point here is that we don't know holomorphy, okay, which is what's conjectured. We know meromorphic continuation here. The twisting operation in Bayes' theorem and in this result here corresponds, in this case, to taking a tensor product of representation. So this LS rho cross chi is nothing other than rho tensor chi. Okay? So we can apply Brouwer's theorem multiple times, and we learn the meromorphic continuation of all twists in this case. Okay. So basically, Brouwer's theorem tells you everything we need to know here. The for conditions 1 prime, 2 prime, and 3 prime. Okay. So we get meromorphic continuation, ratio of entire functions of finite order that follows from the corresponding facts for Hecke L functions, and the functional equation. Now I should point out here this is the correct functional equation in the sense of V. So I was scolded by Langlands when I gave this talk at Princeton for not pointing that out. It's a very difficult calculation to prove that that you do get the correct functional equation out of this, but it does happen. Okay, I guess so. There's one more ingredient that doesn't come directly from Brouwer's theorem, so I need this control of the poles, okay, of the twists, and that boils down to a non-vanishing statement for Hecke L functions on the line 1, okay, which is also known. All right, but basically the conclusions of Brouwer's theorem exactly match these hypotheses 1 prime, 2 prime, and 3 prime. The one thing that we don't know is this condition 4. So what we get in the corollary and now I'm taking a two-dimensional representation, which is the case to which this theorem applies. Okay. So if my LS rho is not modular, then, well, we know 0 through 3 prime here, so the only thing that can fail is 4. Then it has infinitely many poles. In particular, if you assume Artin's conjecture that this function is entire, entire conjecture for Atlas Row implies modularity. Okay. Or in other words, if Artin was right, then so is Langlands. Okay, so first I'm going to sketch a proof of this before we dive in to it. So here's how it works. Okay. Well, let's suppose that some twisted L function has a pole. Then we'll show that LSF itself has infinitely many. So on the other hand, if LSF has at most finitely many poles, then no twisted L function can have a pole. Okay? We get, and the whole game here is just to show holomorphy. That's all we have to show in the end of the twists. Okay? The way it works is as follows. I'm going to write down a certain analytic sum over the poles of LSF. It'll be a residue sum. Okay. And then, by a squiggly arrow, which I'll tell you later, okay, this is related to a certain integral of an additive twist, a so-called additive twist. What that means is the following. So it's what I call LSF alpha. And what you do, it's also a twisted L function, but you twist the coefficients by an additive character rather than a multiplicative one. So okay. E of is e to the 2 pi I. Okay. And so what is this alpha? It'll be for us a non-zero rational number. All right, well, at least on the upper half plane, these additive twists are quite natural objects. Okay? They carry the same information as multiplicative twists in the following sense. Okay, I can, by Fourier analysis, expand my character chi here. Into exponentials. So say chi has conductor q. Okay. Chi bar of t e of minus nt over q. Okay. If you take this equation, sum on n to the minus a and n to the minus s, this gives me a corresponding decomposition of the twisted L function. So, t over q. Okay, which this is the additive twist by t over q here. All right, you can also do this in the other direction. I won't go through that. It's a bit messy because you have to deal with things like imprimitive characters, but using multiplicative. Fourier analysis on the multiplicative group Z mod QZ here, you can relate a given additive twist to some kind of combination of these multiplicative twists. Okay, the point is, all the properties that we know about the multiplicative twists, here are the properties here, you know, mirror morphic continuation and ratio of entire functions of finite order carries over to the additive twist. Okay, so you get mirror morphic continuation of those. And some control over the poles, so the poles can only be inside the critical strip. Okay. I'll say this is, so in passing between primitive and imprimitive characters, that's the point where I use the Euler product, and that's the only point. Okay. So and you could probably remove the assumption of the Euler product if you put something about imprimitive characters in there. Okay. Just to be... Right, but you still have imprimitive characters of prime conductor also. There's one of them. right? that you have to know about. So, which is why I don't need to know very much about the Euler product. I only work one prime at a time. Okay. So more to the point here, how does this carry the same information? Well, I've assumed here that this left-hand side has a pole, so at least one guy on the right-hand side must also have a pole. Okay, so we can choose an alpha such that LS F alpha, additive twist, has a pole. Okay. Then the goal is, the usual thing to do in analytic number theory, you define the right L function and then shift contours, and we're going to pull out a main term here that will show that this sum over poles must have been infinitely long. Okay, so there couldn't possibly be finitely many of them. All right, so that's the overview. Let's dive in. This will be, I'll just present here a special case, because there are many cases to consider, but it'll be the case where the answer corresponds to a holomorphic form of weight 1. Okay. So this will establish this corollary in the case that rho is odd. Okay. All right. Basically, what that means for us is the gamma factor is pretty simple. So the exact sum over the poles that I want to consider is as follows. Okay, a residue of the following expression. So these are poles of LSF. And here is the gamma factor for our case, 2 pi to the minus s gamma of s, simply, if k equals 1. All right, and I put in some extra factors, so I have to tell you what all of these things are. So alpha, I'll take to be a positive rational number, so the rational number that we came up with here, so I said LSF alpha has a pole. Okay. Delta is a parameter strictly between 0 and pi over 2, but you should think of delta going to 0, delta a small number. The reason is that, notice, so if delta is 0, just for a moment, then I've got an e to the I pi over 2 times minus s. Okay? This gamma factor decays like e to the minus pi over 2 t in both the upper and half and lower half planes. So in one half plane, in the upper half plane in particular, the decay of the gamma factor is canceled by this decay, or this exponential growth here. The other half plane is augmented, so we can basically forget those terms, except that I'm modifying the phase here by a small angle delta. Okay, so the upshot of that is that more or less this counts, okay, I'll put that in quotes, poles with imaginary part t between about 0 and 1 over delta, okay, roughly. So I also need quotation marks because, this isn't really a precise statement. This is an oscillatory sum, okay? It doesn't have just positive terms in it. So you might expect some square root cancellation and that sort of thing. But we can hope that if there are many poles, that this sum will detect it, at least. Okay? And certainly, conversely, if there are only finitely many poles, then this expression is completely regular, even when delta equals 0. Okay? So this will certainly converge. So the goal will be to show that as delta goes to 0, that this sum diverges. So there must be some infinitely many terms. So what is M? Finally, M will be some positive integer that I'll choose later. Okay. The reason I need it is it will turn out that even though there are infinitely many poles in some cases, without this extra M, they could conspire and actually converge because of the oscillatory nature of this sum. Okay, so I want to help it diverge a little bit by putting an extra polynomial factor out there. That's the only reason. Okay. Well, the point of writing down a residue sum is to convert it into an integral, right? So the integral I have, this is just a pure sum of residues. The integral will be just the integral of this thing. Okay, and I want to do it around, around a region that contains all of the poles. We know they're all inside the critical strip. So I'm going to integrate on the one hand around, say, 1 plus epsilon, okay, here, going upwards, and the other around minus epsilon. Okay. Well, then I'm going to take this contour and apply on this second contour here, the left one, I'm going to apply the functional equation for LSF, okay, which will take S to 1 minus S, but then flip this contour back over to here. Okay. So I'll get two terms involving LSF and LSF contragradient, okay, from the functional equation. All right, if you do that, precisely what you get is the following. I'll just skip the details here. All right. LSF alpha. Okay, so this is the term from F itself. Here are the terms from the other side of the functional equation. Okay. LS F contragradient. Okay, and then there's a gamma factor here. So DS. So where did this stuff come from? Well, this factor here comes from the second side of the functional equation. Because I took S to 1 minus S, basically this I changes to a minus I here, okay? And we get a factor of the conductor. Alpha changes to 1 over alpha. We get a factor of the conductor coming from the functional equation. And because of this S minus half to the M, there's a minus 1 to the M here, okay? All right. So what do we do with this? Well, first of all, I'd like to get rid of this ugly gamma factor here. With this S minus half to the M. This is kind of unmanageable in the form it's in. Okay, so the thing to do is to write S minus half to the M as, in terms of ascending factorials, okay, I mean this, okay, BM S, S plus 1, S plus M minus 1. Okay, you can write down such an expansion. You multiply both sides by gamma of S, okay, and using the recursion relation for gamma, this is simply that. Okay, for these particular numbers B, you get some expansion of this gamma factor in terms of simpler ones, like that. One reason that I chose this case to present is the ease in coming up with such an expansion like this. Okay. In general, so in the Mass form case, for example, you don't get such nice numbers, and I have to use Stirling's formula at that point, including an estimate of the error terms. And what I do today, there won't be any error terms. So, not at the beginning, at least. Okay, then if we substitute this expression into that integral, right there. Okay, then I get a sum of terms over k, okay, of integrals that look like the following. So if I set for a shorthand, I'll write this alpha e to the I pi over 2 as z, e to the I pi over 2 minus delta. Okay. Thanks. Okay, I'll set that equal to z. Then the integrals I want are, okay, I've got a sum of terms that look like this. Okay, yes. Okay, so this is for the left-hand term. We'll get something similar for the right-hand. Okay, I'll just work it out for the left-hand sum, and then we'll kind of divine the answer for the right one. Okay. All right. So pulling out z to the half and using the Dirichlet series for LSF, this is Everyone see that? I just plug in here. This is sum of a n n to the minus s. Okay, so you get exactly, you pull out a z to the half, you get exactly this. After changing order of sum and integral. So we have to assume that we're integrating far to the right here. But there's no problem with that. And fortunately, this is an integral we can do, okay, at this point. So this is an inverse Mellin transform. Okay, does anyone recognize what it is? E to the minus t, t to the k. What it is. Yeah. Okay. So this is initially defined for t, a positive real number, but by analytic continuation, you can extend this to real t greater than 0, okay, which is exactly in the situation, exactly where we are. So this z is a number in the right half plane. Okay, multiply by n, I get a number in the right half plane, and that's what I have. So I want to use that identity. An 2 pi nz to the k, e to the minus 2 pi nz. Okay. Oh, shoot, here. Let's see, how do I want to do this? All right, perfect. Now let's expand in terms of z what this actually is. So this e to the minus 2 pi nz. By nz. Okay, is. So e to the I pi over 2 is I, of course, and alpha e to the minus I delta. Okay. And now you can see basically where this additive twist is going to come in. Okay. So think of delta as a very small number, then basically this right here is e of minus n delta, or e of minus n alpha. If delta is exactly 0, then this is true. Okay. Because delta is not exactly 0, we'll have you add and subtract 1 from this, okay, and you get exp minus 2 pi n alpha e to the, so you get something at 1, e to the minus I delta minus 1, which looks like a sine function. So it turns out to be exactly this. And here is another decaying exponential. This is going to give me a sum. So now, if I sum this, I've got basically a sum of the twisted coefficients, a n e of minus n alpha, okay, against a function that starts to decay rapidly once n is bigger than 1 over delta. Okay, so this would be a sum of the coefficients of length 1 over delta. Okay. Precisely what you want to do is use this this identity backwards again to convert this into an integral, but now against the twisted L function. Okay. So what you get exactly is, okay, there are a lot of details to work out here. I'll just tell you what the answer is. Okay, but the key feature is here, now we're against the twisted L function, LSF alpha, minus S e to the I. Okay, so this factor here comes from the fact that this is a sum of length 1 over delta, basically. Okay. All right, now I do this for each k and then collect all of the terms. So we're going to have a sum over k here. And we'll also have a factor including the right-hand side of this, which is unfortunately now erased. So, but if you do that, so I'll tell you what you get. Sum equals 0 to m. Okay, so there are m plus 1 terms in in this, bk times this expression here. So there's that factor. Now there's going to be a second factor for the other side of the functional equation. Okay, so if you remember, so there was a minus epsilon minus 1 to the m, and then in place of alpha we had 1 over n alpha, okay, and a half minus s, and here we'll have the contragradient L function, also twisted by an additive character. Since we have 1 over n alpha, this will be also 1 over n alpha, except that also in this integral we change I to minus I. Okay, so that means we have to do it inside the twist also. That means this will be a minus 1 over n alpha. Okay. All right. And here, change I to minus I here. We get I over 2. K plus a half. Okay, and then finally a gamma factor. So delta over 2 to the minus s plus k. Yes. All right. So as big and ugly as this expression is, I'm going to try to convince you that it's not so bad. Okay. So what we know here is that this LSF alpha has a pole somewhere in the critical strip. Okay? We don't know anything about this second term. But let's just suppose that for the moment that this set of parentheses here still has a pole, okay, at the same place, that it's not canceled by this second term. Now the most important term here is when k is as large as possible, because that'll give us the largest power of 1 over delta. So what I'm going to do in the end is take delta to 0 and try to show that this blows up. Okay, it doesn't converge. Okay. All right. So that's why k equals m is the most important term here. If the k equals m term does have a pole, then all of the other terms will be of lower order and they won't be important. Okay. So the thing to focus on is k equals m here. And in fact, I'm going to write. I'm going to call this set of parentheses here, for k equals m, we'll set this to f of s and delta. Okay, it's an expression that depends only on s and delta, right there. Okay, and let's call f not s is what happens in this integral when delta goes to 0. Okay, so that's f of s 0. If you work this out exactly, it's pi over 2 m plus a half. Oh, I need a new piece of chalk here. That's just setting delta equal to 0 in that set of parentheses, and k equals m. Okay, so you pull out this factor here. All right, and let's define an error term. So define f1 of s and delta so that to be what? So this is the zero Taylor coefficient of this, basically, at delta equals 0. Okay, so that fs delta is f0 of s plus delta F1 of S delta. Okay, by standard estimates on Taylor coefficients, this vanishes to at least order 1 in delta. This is a holomorphic function in delta, by the way. Okay, so this F1 of S is regular even when delta goes to 0. Okay. All right, then precisely what I want to say here is if it's the case that this F0 has a pole, okay, so we know that this LSF alpha has a pole somewhere in the critical strip, and here's F0 of S. it includes this term. If this second term doesn't miraculously cancel out that pole, okay, then we're in good shape. So has a pole at, say, S equals beta plus IT, okay, then we'll get a main term, okay, that just comes from integrating that part here. Okay. Okay, so this is the coefficient BM. Times 2 sine delta over 2 to the minus S plus M. Okay. And my claim is that this will be large. So basically you want to shift the contour, you'll pick up a residue from that pole. Okay. And so you'll get a term that includes a residue from that pole, and it'll be basically delta to the minus beta plus M. Okay. This is not quite right because there could be many poles, all right? And if you analyze what happens there, you have to pay a price here. Okay? And the price you pay is an epsilon in the exponent. Okay. Does this make sense? So what this is basically, so this omega notation just means that this thing gets as large as this negative power of delta infinitely often. Okay. So this is not small. It's not O of this. In other words, for any epsilon. Okay. Not all of them, but certainly the last one. Yeah, because this is the main term, right? It'll be one, in fact. No, it matters critically what the BMs are, in fact. So we'll see. There is a calculation to be done here, and you really can't believe this fact until you see the last line. Of what I write down. So, but what do we get to the other term? So that, okay, if we do have this pole, the other terms, well, there's, so all the terms for k less than m, okay, and the thing to do there is shift to real S equals 1 plus epsilon, okay, and we'll get. Okay, the point is, so if k is less than m, you get at least a delta to the 1 power savings here. Okay? And so you'll get O epsilon delta to the minus m plus epsilon. Okay? This is also true for the F1 term. So we pulled out just a constant term in delta. But again, for the F1 term, there's a power savings of 1 in delta. Okay, so basically, you want to set k equal to m minus 1 here and s equal to 1 plus epsilon. Okay, that's exactly what you get. You get this O epsilon delta to the minus m plus epsilon. Since I have this assumption on the poles that they can only be strictly inside this critical strip, beta is greater than 0, and we win. Okay, this main term dominates over the error. We get something that that explodes, and this sum must be infinitely long. Okay, so we're done. All right. Unfortunately, we can't conclude straight away that that we have a pole here. Okay. It could be the case that this contragradient factor has a pole in exactly the same place in such a way that they all cancel out, that miraculously. Okay. But what we do know, okay, all is not lost because of the following. So if not, okay, then F naught is entire. And what that means is we have precise control over the poles of this contragradient term. We know exactly where they are. They're in exactly the same place as the poles of LSF alpha. Okay? So the thing to do is we write this contragradient term, okay, 1 over n alpha half minus s. You write this term in terms of LSF alpha itself, okay, and F naught. So if you do that, if you unravel this, it turns out to be the following. Now I want to substitute this expression for the contragredient term back into the whole thing over here. Okay. Now so far I haven't said anything about m. I'm at complete freedom to choose m, and at this point I'm going to take m to be an odd number. Okay? Basically because I want to fix the sign over here, this minus 1 to the m. Okay? If you do that, then, let's mentally substitute this expression. So let's look at this part. If I put in this part for this contragredient expression, you'll get LSF alpha both here and here. Okay? And you'll get an e to the I, this, plus e to the minus I, that. You get a cosine. Okay? So that's the first term here. Okay, plus some constant factors. Here's what they turn out to be. If I had chosen m odd, I'd get a similar expression, but with sine. Right. Sorry? No, m is odd, so I get a plus here, the minus.
Yeah. Okay.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, if I had chosen m even, I'd get a sine expression. Yeah. Okay. Times. Okay. Plus a term involving f not of s. Okay. No. This is the assumption here, that there's no pole. Okay, so they're equal up to a holomorphic function. Okay, they're not equal. They're equal up to a holomorphic function here. But this is a key observation, because now this term involving f not of s, I'm not going to write it out, because it's completely holomorphic and I can shift the contour as far to the left as I want. The first pole you can possibly encounter there is a pole of the gamma function. Okay. So when this argument is zero, but then you just get a delta to the zero. Okay, which is harmless for us. We're trying to detect stuff going to infinity. Okay, in this case it turns out because these are holomorphic forms, there actually won't be any poles. These things will have trivial zeros also. In the Mossform case they could though. So, but anyways, the upshot is this is O of 1. Okay? So now I've got everything in terms of only one L function. Okay? And if I've done my calculation right, okay, I've done my calculation right, or at least made an even number of mistakes. Right? You should. The trouble with saying that is that too many people have heard this talk and they've all heard the same jokes. So, okay. Yeah. What do I want to do? This main term should cancel when k equals m, identically. Okay, because we've taken out the part from f naught. Okay, and if k equals m and m is an odd number, as delta goes to zero, we get cosine pi m over 2. Which is zero. That's good. Okay. All right, so the thing to look at is this cosine expression. What we really want to know is, all right. So when k equals m and delta goes to zero, this vanishes identically. So of course it cancels all the poles. Okay. What I want to show you is that it can't possibly vanish to arbitrary order here. Okay. So by passing to, say, the first derivative, I'll still be able to pull out the main term. Okay. So let me show you that. The thing to look at is this set of parentheses. Okay, and if out of this, so I've got several terms here for k from 0 to m. If I pull out the biggest factor of 1 over delta here, which is this to the minus s plus m out of everything, okay, then what I'm looking at is is this. So the integral is this expression, sum over k, times the L function, times 2 sine delta over 2 to the minus s plus n. Okay? So let's look at where the zeros of this thing can possibly be. Okay? So what I want to do is a more precise version of this this argument over here. Here I used only the zero Taylor coefficient. Now I'm going to use higher order coefficients. So this will be phi 0 of s, phi 1 of s delta, okay, up to some point phi n of s delta to the n plus the remainder term. Okay, and again, by standard estimates, this decays to order delta to the n plus 1. Okay, if I stop at delta to the n. Okay, then the argument is similar. So let's suppose that, well, we know phi s is identically 0. Phi 0 of s is identically 0. Let's suppose that some phi n does not cancel all poles of LSF alpha. Okay. In fact, let's choose n to be the minimal such. Okay. Then all of these other terms, all the lower terms, of course, will be holomorphic. Okay. I can shift the contour far to the left. They're like F naught. Okay. So they'll give me O of 1, in fact. What we'll get then, though, is a main term. Okay, for phi equals okay. So we get the main term. And if, again, if this doesn't cancel these poles, then this expression has a pole. It's a beta plus IT. Okay. And as before, this will be large, minus beta plus M. The price I've paid here is a minus N. Okay. I'm going to control that by upping this M. That's the point of the of that. Okay. And again, other terms. Okay, so all of these lower terms are holomorphic. You shift far to the left, you get O of 1. And this term here, this error term, you get, again, a power savings of 1 over what you're looking at here. Okay, so that's like F1. And the other terms are O epsilon of delta to the minus and minus N plus epsilon. Okay, as long as beta is greater than 0 and N is less than or equal to M, okay, we win. We win. Okay. What I have to show you here in the last 2 minutes is that this does happen. Let me go over here. You might ask, well, why is all of this necessary? I mean, why can't we conclude in some natural way that it has to be that for some n this is true? After all, I'm saying that this can't possibly vanish to arbitrarily high order. Okay, but no. So it turns out that it can, and let me show you why. So it's enough to take n equals m equals 1. Okay, so I didn't really have to carry around this n and m over the whole proof. I could have just done with 1. Okay, if you... So this is the expression in this case. Okay. So here's that sum I wrote down, n equals m equals 1. And phi 1 of s, the first derivative term, if you just take the derivative in delta, set it equal to 0. Use the functional equation, or use the recursion relation for gamma. you get this. Okay, now the question is, where are the zeros of this thing? Where can they possibly cancel the zero of LSF alpha? So there can only be at most two zeros right here. And I want to show you that this actually can, why this is necessary, this factor. Okay, I never use anywhere that my, if I apply this to a Galois representation, for example, I never use the fact that it's irreducible. Okay, I could apply the same argument here to an Eisenstein series, say LS, where one of these is even, one is odd. Okay, then the gamma factor of this thing is the same thing as for a holomorphic form. Okay, and yet this thing does have a twist with a pole. Okay, at exactly s equals 1, it has a twist with a double pole. All right, you can make it with a double pole. Coming from the Riemann zeta function. So I know that, and in order to conclude that this, which is an entire function, does not have infinitely many poles, the only way out is to assume that there's a pole here, or a zero here at s equals 1. Okay. Once there's one zero here at s equals 1, there are two, because the sum of the zeros is 2. Okay. So I know from that that this factor must be 2 pi to the minus s, gamma of s, s minus 1 squared. Okay. In particular, it can't cancel anything in the critical strip, and we're finished. Okay. If you don't believe me, by the way, so you can just work this out. In this case, my original gamma factor of m equals 1 is this, which is gamma of, what is it, minus a half gamma of s plus gamma of s plus 1. So b0 is minus a half, and b1 is 1. Okay, and you get s squared minus 2s plus 1. Okay. This is what I meant when I said you have to go through the whole calculation before you can possibly believe it here. Okay.